From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. The formal occupation of Iraq lasted only 14 months. The U.S. handed power to Iraq's interim government in a quiet ceremony yesterday. Originally, the United States set lofty and far-reaching goals for its presence in Iraq, to rid Iraq of weapons of mass destruction, to bring democracy to a long-oppressed people, to defeat terrorism, and to set an example for the Middle East, a region dominated by authoritarian regimes. As NPR's Mike Schuster reports, if the deserts of Iraq suited the U.S. invasion, the post-war terrain proved far more difficult to master.
None of the stated goals for the occupation have been met yet, and many experts, such as Gideon Rose, the managing editor of the journal Foreign Affairs, are skeptical that they ever will.
Historians will look on the Iraq occupation as a case study in how not to follow up a war, how to diminish the odds of success and undermine your own objectives. Basically, this administration has done almost everything wrong once the war ended that it could have done.
In the process, without declaring it outright, the United States has gradually lowered its sights, according to Sandy Berger, National Security Advisor during the Clinton administration.
We were going to have transformation of Iraq. We were going to have peace between Palestinians and Israelis. We were going to have democracy in the Middle East. And now we're basically really struggling for whether we can create a stable, pluralistic, peaceful Iraq. That's a long way from where we started.
Most of the leading policymakers of the Bush administration, from the president on down, have not conceded this point, however. This is Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul Wolfowitz testifying last week before a congressional panel. Wolfowitz was one of the administration's key proponents of the transformational vision of the Iraq occupation.
I think we're at a point now of a change that is properly described as historic. For the first time in almost half a century, Iraq is about to have a sovereign government that is committed to the rule of law, to the values of freedom and democracy.
But many experts argue there is no certainty yet that Iraq will evolve into a democracy. Many hold that view because Iraq has no experience with democratic government. But Gideon Rose also blames the short-sighted assumptions of the administration, which sent an army into battle without a clear plan for the post-invasion process. Rose attributes this to the administration's dismissive attitude toward what came to be known in the 1990s as nation-building.
Democracy is a form of government. It presupposes a government. It presupposes a state. And the degree of state-building that was going to be necessary was dramatically underestimated by the administration.
In fact, the administration assumed Iraqis would look upon the invasion as a liberation, and that without Saddam Hussein in power, the Iraqi public would simply get to work building a new government, with Iraq's oil exports paying for it all. Paul Wolfowitz reluctantly acknowledged this in his testimony last week.
If you want to say what might have been underestimated, I think there was probably too great a willingness to believe that once we got the 55 people on the blacklist, the rest of those killers would stop fighting.
That false assumption, combined with far too few troops to secure the peace, led to many unforeseen consequences. The administration did not anticipate the widespread looting that took place. That ensured that essential services such as electricity and water would be impossible to restore quickly, and they are still spotty in much of Iraq. That quickly sparked widespread anger and dissatisfaction with the U.S. presence, and in turn contributed to the insurgency that exploded only a few months after President Bush declared major combat operations over. Senator Lindsey Graham, Republican from South Carolina, acknowledged this equation after he returned from a trip to Iraq last week.
When the water and the sewer and the power was fixed, when they had full power, drinkable water, and the sewage problem was taken care of, the attacks went down by 90%. Where those problems were unsolved, it's a hotbed of terrorism.
Indeed, Iraq's open borders have encouraged foreign fighters to come to Iraq. If Iraq was not the central front in the war on terrorism before the invasion, it certainly is now. Many critics of the occupation agree with the administration on one thing, though, that stability will come to Iraq only when Iraqis form the bulk of the army and police. But here, too, the goals of the administration have not been met. Administration military and civilian officials have talked about as many as 200,000 Iraqi troops and police soon to be deployed in the field. But Senator Joe Biden, Democrat of Delaware, who also visited Iraq last week, says the actual numbers are far smaller. Biden was especially critical of the program to train Iraqi police, an 8-week course in neighboring Jordan.
We do not have an adequate training program in place. There is this mythical notion that we can train up thousands of Iraqi police in the next several months. And 8 weeks is misleading the Iraqi people, misleading the American people, misleading everyone as to whether or not there would be a capacity.
Those Iraqi police who have been deployed have quickly become a target for the insurgency, which attacked police stations in five Iraqi cities last Thursday in an unexpectedly coordinated assault. Unexpected is the key word here. Perhaps the single greatest failing of the United States in Iraq, civilian and military, has been intelligence. Intelligence about the insurgents and intelligence about the political currents in the country. The problem began even before the war. The first intelligence failure ended up undermining the administration's stated reasons for the invasion, notes former National Security Advisor Sandy Berger.
The administration's first rationale, which was to rid Iraq of its weapons of mass destruction, proved to be wrong. The administration's second rationale, that we had to stop Saddam Hussein from giving dangerous weapons to al-Qaeda terrorists to use against the United States, never made sense to me.
Many experts now see that first intelligence failure, based in part on false information from Iraqi exiles, as emblematic of difficulties the United States has encountered every step of the way in Iraq. Jeffrey Record is author of Dark Victory, America's Second War Against Iraq.
We didn't have any decent intelligence on weapons of mass destruction. I think when this whole story of our invasion and occupation of Iraq is over, I think it's going to be littered with the corpses of one intelligence failure after another.
After the invasion, poor military intelligence meant the explosion of the insurgency last August came as a surprise. That put pressure on the military to get better intelligence on the insurgents, and that contributed in turn to the abuses at Abu Ghraib and other U.S. prisons in Iraq. Overall, says Gideon Rose of Foreign Affairs, the United States has exhibited a poor understanding all along of what's been going on in Iraq.
Intelligence on an insurgency is never really a matter of sort of spying and secret sources and cracking codes and so forth. It's a matter of getting the population on your side and making them realize that they have an interest in cooperating with you and turning in the people who are doing this. We never got the population on our side sufficiently to have them provide the kind of intelligence that would have allowed us to help suppress the insurgency.
And that, in Jeffrey Record's view, rests on the erroneous assumptions of the administration's key Iraq policymakers.
I think the most vociferous war hawks within the administration were, in many respects, neoconservative ideologues who did not really understand Iraqi society and who assumed that U.S. military power could do things that, in fact, it really can't do. There was not an appreciation of the limits of American military power in a setting of an Arab heartland in which you are occupying and trying to engineer some kind of gigantic political revolution there. There was a lot of wishful thinking and a lot of willful refusal to look at things that really could go wrong and look at the experience of the region.
So now, despite the lofty rhetoric, the goals have become more modest. The suppression of the insurgency, the return of essential services, providing security so that Iraqis can go to work and children can go to school, and protecting the interim government over the next 6 months, so that Iraq's first national elections might finally be held. Mike Schuster, NPR News.